All right, good evening. So right livelihood. So when I see that word livelihood, I'm curious how many people in the room are still feel like they're working? All right, and so that's about half the people. So other people perhaps are retired, perhaps students, perhaps caregiving, a child, an elderly parent, perhaps themselves. So wherever you find yourself on that spectrum, whether you're in the middle of your working years, at the end, or life circumstances are different, that you're maybe getting ready to start something, caring for someone, it's how do you spend your life? How do you spend your day? The most of your day is how we're defining this word livelihood. So hopefully everyone will feel that sense of engagement in this topic, in this exploration. So Terry's been leading the last few months, so I'm going to find my way into this topic. I'll be basically taking over. Should be here next week, but then I'll be continuing on to the end of the year. So finding my own entry into this topic of the Eightfold Path. So I'd like to start by reviewing the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path to see how everything fits together and how wise livelihood, or right livelihood, is part of that picture. And we'll focus in on that topic. So the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So these, we can look at them as discrete pieces, the four and the eights, but really they're very much intertwined, very interconnected. We can't separate them out truly. If we do, we're just making one in isolation. So it starts really with this Four Noble Truths, understanding what is dukkha, what is this quality of suffering, of dis-ease, of dissatisfaction, unsatisfactoriness of this moment's experience. What's the origination of that dukkha? And what's the cessation of that dukkha? This is the Four Noble Truths. And the Fourth Noble Truth is the path leading to the end of dukkha. Right? So you can see already we have this all very interconnected. We can't have one in isolation. So how we understand dukkha, understand the origination and the cessation of that, each one of us is in a different place, perhaps, with that. Whether we're just starting off in the practice, or we've been practicing for 20 or 30 years, we have a certain orientation, a certain understanding. And the practice is about deepening that understanding, allowing it to be something that's constantly evolving and growing as our understanding grows and deepens. And so there's this process of constantly refining and clarifying, really, what is dukkha? How does it show up, not as an abstract thought, but as it actually shows up in this mind and body right here? How does it show up in my relationships, in my work, in my actions? And so as we walk this path, it starts to refine our understanding. Our understanding changes. As our understanding changes, then in turn changes our path, how we actually walk that. So they're very interconnected, very interrelated. So the Eightfold Path has these three main sections. Right? The first section is wisdom, we could say. The wise understanding, wise view, and wise aim, or wise intention. It sets our purpose for practicing, how we actually meet this breath. How do we actually meet this experience? How do we meet this difficult situation at work, in our families? So our understanding of the Four Noble Truths and our intention to engage with that, these are the first two aspects of the wisdom factor. Then the middle section is of action. And this is the section that we're starting to move into this month, the next 2 months. How do we actually use our understanding of the Four Noble Truths to engage in how we act in the world, how we show up, how we speak, how we work? And it's both how we cultivate the path in our daily lives, but also how we really prove the path, how we actually confirm the path works. Because if we just have this, we just practice on our by ourselves and our cushions, and when the bell rings, we're done. We just kind of forget about it. It's a very limited value. I'm very interested in how does it show up in our lives, in the very nitty-gritty details, the grit of our lives, in our relationships, in our way we work, the way we speak, you know, the choices we make. Constantly those inform, those are always being informed or directed by something, right? If it's not being directed by the Dharma, if it's not being directed by the Four Noble Truths, then what is it being directed by? You know, perhaps fear, perhaps greed, perhaps anger. These are the delusion. These are the qualities that often direct many of our actions. But for our practice to really deepen, we have to start to bring that into the bedrock of our lives. Now, in the three aspects of this action section, we have wise speech or right speech. We have right action and right livelihood. Now, Tweri and I decided to switch the order for some reason. It was an intentional switch, and I don't actually remember why we did that. And so we put livelihood first, but really it should be wise speech, wise action, and then wise livelihood. And as you explore this, you see that that's actually was pretty wise of the Buddha to put it in that order. We start to understand, look at how we speak and how we act, that naturally informs how we work, how we do our livelihood, our caretaking, our householder life. Because if we truly are following right speech and right action, then right livelihood more or less takes care of itself. I think it's important to highlight it because we have to really see, is this truly aligned with our understanding? This understanding grows, it changes. You know, again, from the first day, you have a certain understanding of how the practice works. And later on, as our insights and our practice matures, that understanding also develops, also becomes transformed by that. And so it's a constantly evolving process. So with the support of wise speech and wise action, livelihood is really much supported. So last week, Tweri talked about it's very common for people to ask questions about issues at work. You know, how do I deal with this difficult coworker, this boss, this person I'm supervising, this customer, whatever it might be? Right? And so we'll have some time for questions about those. But I think it's always helpful when you have a struggle is to just step back for a moment and run through the precepts. Run through this sense of, okay, am I causing any harm to myself, to others? Am I stealing in some way? Am I taking which is not freely offered? Am I speaking truth? Or am I having a sense of deceit, a sense of hiding the truth? Am I in some ways acting for my sexuality in a way that's not appropriate, that's leading to harm? Or am I having a sense of heedlessness, a sense of being not connected with the actual reality of the moment? So going through these, we can start to see with these issues at work, if our ethics aren't lined up, if we're not acting from an ethical place, that creates much turbulence, much unrest in our work lives. And sometimes you can notice your own mind. If you have a particular sticking spot and you tend to elaborate a lot about that, you know, say, okay, I can justify why I'm doing that behavior, you know, why I'm taking the company's pens or whatever it might be. You know, I can, when I start to elaborate, that's often a clue that I am a little off there. Because when we really touch into the truth of things, there's a way that it leads to stillness. It leads to quiet. When we touch something that's true in ourselves, it naturally leads to stillness. If we touch something that's not quite true, it leads to more papancha, more elaboration of thought. So these three aspects of the Eightfold Path, the wisdom section, the action section, and finally the cultivation section, the cultivation aspect. So cultivation has wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. Now this word cultivation, that's the Pali word described as bhavana. So often we translate that as meditation. But cultivation has this different quality, doesn't it? Like you're cultivating this environment for something else to grow. This quality of cultivation. So our meditation practice starts to develop our capacity to see clearly, to see directly with immediacy. And what we're trying to see is the origination of, we see dukkha, the origination of dukkha, and the cessation of dukkha. That's really the whole point of the practice, to see that in deeper and deeper levels until there's a complete seeing of that, a complete liberation. Now that clear seeing starts to transform our speech, our actions, our livelihood. And then as our speech, our actions, our livelihood starts to get cleaned up, as we start to become more and more aligned with our seeing, we naturally experience an internal quiet. We start to become quieter inside. That in turn supports a deeper seeing, a deeper quality of meditation, of mindfulness, a deeper steadiness of concentration. So you can see how there's a constant reinforcing, constant feedback between these two elements. So we start the practice wherever we are, wherever our understanding is. And the good news, as long as we practice sincerely, it starts to naturally deepen, especially if we take it off the cushion into our daily lives. It's actually seeing, well, how do I actually interact with someone? How do I interact with this work, with this these things I do in my life? Can that my practice start to inform that, start to become one and the same? When we do that, then they really support each other, and the practice naturally deepens. So this is a quick overview of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So now let's move in, focus in on this path factor of wise livelihood. Wise livelihood. I'd like to begin by focusing on the more traditional way of looking at wise livelihood, but then going on to two other aspects that go a little bit beyond that traditional meaning. So kind of the fundamental, essential aspect of wise livelihood is non-harm. Is non-harm. Do we make our living in a way that does not cause harm to ourselves and to others? This is the bottom line, the fundamental aspect of that. And the Buddha talked about in his time five main areas of dealing in weapons, dealing in living beings, dealing in meat production or butchery, in poisons or intoxicants. So these are kind of the areas that cause quite a bit of harm. They're really overtly based on causing harm. That's how the profit flows from that. Also, he's mentioned practicing, earning your money, your support through deceit, through treachery, soothsaying, trickery, and being basically a loan shark. Right, so just, you know, keep that list in mind that, you know, most of us don't fall into that list. So your livelihood is more or less wise, right? Sometimes there's a lot of tension that rises up. Is my work spiritual enough? Is it spiritual enough to be a counselor, to be a teacher, to be a mail carrier, a grocery clerk? Whatever it might be, there's that sense of I need to be more spiritual. Wise livelihood is really about not causing harm. We're talking a little bit about how to make that livelihood, whatever it is, something of the spiritual. But that's the baseline, is does my work cause harm? Is it directly going harming? Is it killing? Is it through stealing? Is there a sexual misconduct? Am I making my living through deceit, through not telling the truth, for deceiving? or through promoting heedlessness, through intoxication. So again, as we go through that list, any areas that feel like I have to kind of justify that, have to explain why I do that, it's important just to investigate that, to sit with that, to notice, okay, is this really aligned with my deepest understanding? And allow that to evolve, to change. At the same time, we don't want to get too idealistic, because I think if we look closely enough, there's very few work scenarios which don't cause harm in some way. If you look far enough out in the echoes of our life, driving to work, you know, we contribute to greenhouse gases. You know, it's like there's so many nuances we can look at. So just look at the main core thing. Is this causing harm? Now, harm, we often think of it as external harm, but I think it's very important to include internal harm, harm that we do ourselves. Because so many of us, you know, especially like in the helping professions, overwork ourselves, become burned out, overwhelmed. And you know, we put ourselves last. We always give. Okay, so you have to include yourself in this sense of non-harm. Even if the work is very altruistic, most people think you're a saint, but if you're destroying yourself, if you're destroying your relationships, that's an important thing to consider, to really look at. Is there a way that I can still do this work without causing so much internal harm? Or, you know, overuse injuries. Am I hurting myself through sitting in the computer for 10 hours a day? Is there an adequate balance of rest, a relaxation, rejuvenation? I mean, we tend to overwork ourselves in this society. So I think this is another important aspect of wise livelihood, is this internal harm, to include ourselves with this. And we can look at harm, we can also look at the other side of it, and that is of kindness. Does our work promote and lead to kindness in the world, toward ourselves and others? And this is something that's actually very accessible if we turn our attention to it. You know, how do we answer the phone? How do we interact with our coworkers? How do we interact with customers? If we're taking care of children or elderly, how do we interact with them? If we're taking care of ourselves, how do we care for ourselves with kindness? So it's this constant moment of interaction, and how much extra time does it take to be kind? To just pause and say, okay, let me leave with my heart. So non-harm, this is the foundation of this wise livelihood. Now I'm going to move into two other elements which are kind of going beyond that basic non-harm, to start to bring the spiritual into our lives. Not in a way of being, you have to be a meditation teacher, you have to be something that's overtly spiritual, but how can you be spiritual no matter what your work is, no matter what your role of life is? So this first is a sense of aliveness, the sense of aliveness. And this is something that Rodney used to teach around livelihood. It's like, if you're alive in your work, if you're alive in what you do, then it's wise, it's right livelihood. But if you're deadening yourself, if you're shut down, you're enduring, it's not life enhancing, it's not allowing you to really engage. Now think back to whatever work you're doing now, and perhaps it's still very alive and very passionate for you. But for many of us, if we're honest, it may not be so much. You know, if you're retired, thinking back to that, you know, what was the aspiration when you retired? What were you hoping to make this last part of your life around? If you're caring for a child, if you're a homeowner, or you stay at home, if you're caring for people, caring for elderly, caring for yourself. You know, what's that initial delight that you had that made you interested in this line of work, in this way of engaging? Sometimes that gets forgotten as we get caught up in the reality of it and the day-to-day. But we could start to rekindle that, remind ourselves of that passion. Sometimes it's about discovering a new way of being engaged, of really showing up for this moment, for this work. Where can I fully show up and be present? I often, when I go through the day, and maybe I go to the grocery store, I go to the post office, I have to call and talk to someone on the phone. It's often interesting to notice the people who are really engaged in their work. You know, they really show up for you. You know, they might be doing something very mundane, like counting your groceries and scanning them. And some people just go through that in a very dull way. Other people really connect, really engage. And you leave that interaction feeling that sense of aliveness. So that's often inspiring, like, okay, how can I bring that into my own work, my own interactions? Not to discount people I think are not worth connecting with, but to connect with every person. So notice that as you go through your day, which people are really engaged, are really connected, and can you learn, allow that to learn, you to learn about how to engage in your own work, in your own interactions. And as I mentioned, it's important not to worry about your work being spiritual enough. It's often a sense of a lot of internal angst and worry, like, okay, maybe I should, you know, quit my job and join the Peace Corps, or I should, you know, join a nonprofit or something like that. And that's, if your heart's aligned with that, then by all means. But also see, where is your heart come alive in the work that you have? Where can you be engaged in this work? You know, no matter what it is, there's a way that you can engage with it. Now, sometimes you can engage. You cannot engage because the work is unethical, or it's draining, or it's harmful. And when those things, you know, collide, then I think it is important to start to look. Maybe it's better to switch some kind of work, to switch to a different area within what you do, or something completely different. See, when we're engaged with our work, we're engaged with our life, mindfulness is naturally there. You're naturally present. It's not an effort to show up. You're engaged. So that's part of the trick of making your life spiritual, is to finding what allows you to show up, to really engage. Now often we're trying to make ourselves show up. It's like trying to make ourselves be mindful. You know, we probably all experience that when our minds are so restless and so distracted, and just trying to come back to the breath is such hard work, right? There's other times when the breath can become so interesting, just the sense of the breath moving through the body, or feeling the sense of the body sitting. In those times, the mindfulness is naturally present. In daily life, that interest is really finding that point of inquiry. What makes us really, you know, perk up our ears and say, well, let me connect with this? It could be something like dukkha. Maybe dukkha really resonates. You know, where does this sense of unsatisfactoriness show up? This sense of unsubstantiality? Because it seems like, you know, this is this new car, this new role, this new relationship is substantial. It's supposed to bring a quality happiness. But you notice, I don't quite feel that it's paid off. That becomes a point of entry. You know, perhaps there's a quality of, where's my heart come out? Where do I feel most engaged in the moment? And for each one of us, it's our own unique characteristics that brings that forth. So part of the art of being a spiritual practitioner is finding that, to be able to tune yourself to that. And you can be sitting waiting for the overdue bus, and you could choose to go into distraction with your phone or ranting about why the bus is too late. Or you could practice just feeling yourself standing, feeling the breeze against your skin, feeling the heat of the sun. Asking someone how they're doing and really mean it and really connect. This is your life. It's your choice in how you live it. And the choices come up moment after moment. And what you practice is what's going to come more in the future. So if you practice being distracted, being irritated, being frustrated, you're setting the seeds for that to come up. You're cultivating that to come into the future. Right? So finding where's that point of interest? So non-harm, aliveness, and the final aspect I'm going to speak about tonight is around identity. Identity as the person who has that job, that role. The identity of the housekeeper, the parent, the caregiver, the student. That role, that identity. This is, you know, when people ask, so, you know, when they get to know you, what do you do? Who are you? You know, oh, you're a garbage collector, you're a doctor. You know, there's this sense of kind of orienting who you are based on that work. And it's interesting, our society, isn't it, how we have a hierarchy of who is higher up than other people. And, oh, you're that kind of a person, or you're that kind of a person. And we suddenly shift based on that. This is the quality of identification arising, how we hold ourselves as being less than, more than, or equal to. Okay? Less than, more than, or equal to. This is a very fundamental, primal way that we form the sense of self. It's one of the primal ways that we keep ourselves away from liberation. The belief in that, okay, I am better, I am worse, I am the same as. And our work is a tremendous way that we've established that. I mean, many of us have spent years and years cultivating the skills to be a certain role. You know, other of us are perhaps trying to find, what should I do? I've done many different roles. In some ways, it's easier if you've done many roles because you kind of, you know, you can be in that role and then you can shift into this other role. So in this point of identity, how strongly do we hold that role? How strongly do we hold it? The gateway to see that is to always be monitoring the body and its reactions. Okay, the body is not going to lie. It's going to reveal the emotional dis-ease, the sense of feeling your pride being pricked, the sense of feeling diminished, that all echoes in the body. In some ways, in a truer way than our minds can conceive of that. So staying this anchor in our body shows where those are arising. Someone says something to you and you think, oh, you should be treating me with more respect, right? That shows up in the body. Or too much respect, that shows up in the body. So the trick in the spiritual practitioner is not to get distracted by the content, but to notice the process. The content is, oh, you need to call me sir or doctor. Or no, you shouldn't call me that, just call me by my first name, wherever you fall in that. That's getting caught in the content. The process is the way that you're forming and establishing this sense of me, this sense of who I am in that role of work. And reflect how many hours a day, how many years in your life you spend working, you've spent in that role. So of course, you know, for many of us, there should be a certain hardness around it. A certain sense of, this is who I am. We often see that when we retire. And how easy is it for us to set aside that role, the sense of being in control or being productive? How easy is it for us when our children leave our home? That role of being parent has to be changed, has to evolve. So looking at, see how that strongly that role is held. Using the body as a way to explore that, to be with that. The basic formula is the more you hold, the stronger you hold that, the more you're going to suffer. The lighter you hold that, the less suffering there will be. In this case, the origination of dukkha is that holding of that identification. Right? The release of that dukkha is a release of that identification. So these three aspects of what makes livelihood wise or right. When I say right, it's really the sense of alignment with the Dharma. It's that sense of rightness, being upright, being aligned. You know, does it cause harm? Is it based in harmlessness? Is it bring me alive to some degree? Can I find a way of not just waiting till Friday, waiting till I retire, but find that point of engagement in the middle of work, in the middle of my livelihood? An identity. Can I step into that role fully and strongly when I need to? And can I set that aside when it's no longer needed? So in this way, livelihood becomes a gateway into the spiritual. It becomes a way of aligning our understanding, cultivated by meditation, cultivated by the Four Noble Truths, into how it actually shows up in our work lives, in the way we are day to day. When we hear the word wise livelihood, right livelihood, if your mind is at, like me, for years I would kind of say, oh, is my livelihood truly wise? Is it truly right? Right? But that question comes from this sense of insecurity, that sense of not trusting what I knew to be true. So this sense of wise livelihood. Investigate how you work, but don't get so caught up in, okay, is it really spiritual? Is it really this way or that way? But just, is it based on harm? If it's not based on harm, it's wise. Does it bring me alive? That's even more wise. If I can set aside the identity, that's even more wise. So allowing this question to just constantly be alive for you. How is this livelihood? How am I able to make it more and more wise, more and more aligned with my understanding? All right, can we sit quietly for a moment or two and let those words settle? Thank you for your attention. So I just wanted to speak a little bit about the practice and reflection. So again, I mentioned this would be posted online. My computer printer wasn't cooperating, so I didn't bring enough copies. And Tuari will be leading a discussion next week about this. So it starts off by how does your understanding of dukkha, the origination of dukkha, and the cessation of dukkha inform your work? How does it show up in your livelihood? Are those two separate things in your life? There's your spiritual practice and there's your work practice. Or are they starting to meld? Are they starting to bleed together, connect together? And if you're not employed, considering how you spend the majority of your time. Perhaps you're caring for family members or yourself, your household, volunteering. And reflecting on these three aspects. Is your livelihood, is the way you spend your day based in non-harm? Is it based in non-harm toward yourself and others equally? Does it bring you alive? Does it foster a sense of aliveness? And if it doesn't, is there a way that you can start to rekindle that aliveness? or discover it in a fresh way? And finally, how tightly do you hold the self-identity around your work, around your major role in your life? How tightly do you hold that? How easily are you able to set that aside and bring it up, like a change of clothes? So practice with that this next week, and we'll have a discussion next week. So we have some chance for any comments or questions to kind of help flesh out this topic. So I'll be happy to engage as you will. Yes, Sashi.
It's not a question, but I just have a comment that the struggle with identity is something that I went through when I resigned from my professional identity, doing nothing.
Yeah, so the comment is that transition from being a professional to retiring, that wasn't so easy. And it's you've been retired for, 4 years, and it's not completely... Yeah, and it's, how do we, on one hand, there's this skillfulness of how do we work with that really it's a loss, it's a grief. It's similar to if you've lost your partner after 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. There's this big gap in your life and how you orient yourself to that. So there's an aspect of the Dharma is like, okay, that suffering around that is because of the identification. But there's also, how do we work with that skillfully? How do we actually engage with that? And it can bring up some of the most fundamental questions for us. Who am I outside of this role? Who am I outside of this sense of being productive, of being capable, of being in control, of having something to do? And we don't have that. We're thrown back into a much more simple relationship with ourselves. And so that sense of coming back, so there's navigating the grief and the loss and the change of circumstances. And I think it's, whenever it's possible, when someone retires or there's a major change, whether their children leave or they become unemployed or they graduate or they go to school, to mark that transition with some space, some time just to do nothing. Because often there's the urge to fill it in with something new, the next relationship, the next volunteerism, the next, whatever it might be. But feeling that sense of unease, that sense of unrest, because it's practice. It's practice for when we're on our deathbed. That's the biggest role to give up, is that of a living person, right? It's like I have to, and it just gets stripped away one aspect after another. And so when we retire or something, a major change in our life, that's an opportunity to practice that. Right? And it needs space, it needs compassion, it needs care. And you can see, okay, this is how I identify with that. And working with this quality of identification and being lighter and lighter with it is very helpful while we're working, so we can start to pave that way. Being a parent, I get to work with that as my daughter goes from, and she's 14 years now, and so there's that push back, and And when do I, okay, when do I step up and, you know, confront something? And when do I let go? You know, and can I be fluid enough that I'm not doing it because of my own internal need, but because of what's appropriate? You know, and we're in work and someone disses us or has a sense of disrespect, you know, how much do we get engaged in that? How much do we stand up for ourselves? You know, and it's not a right or wrong answer, but just noticing that process. And it's really, it is preparing us for those bigger transitions, including end of life. Yes, Peter.
I appreciated your talk and the point about kind of balancing care of yourself with sort of non-harm. You know,
right, yeah.
And I think maybe the question or the thing that I encounter, I think, influencing how much self-care there is this sense of productivity that's, you know, kind of really emphasized
right
in the workplace. And I think that it can be easy to neglect the care of yourself around that. And some workplaces are actually pretty, clear that is the priority.
Sure. So the comment or question is around holding non-harm equally externally and also internally, that sense of non-harm in ourselves, and how often this, our kind of our modern workforce is so geared toward productivity and competition and getting ahead that often the thing that loses out, and in fact is almost required to lose out, is self-care. And you know, you get rewarded if you, you know, show up early and you leave late and you sacrifice these personal aspects in order to get ahead. I mean, you get more promotions, so it's a way that's really bought in, and certainly some, as you mentioned, some workforce places are more focused on that than others. And so how do you find that point of balance? You know, certainly, as I probably should do full disclosure. If you talk to my wife, she'll say I'm chronically overworked. So I tend to be on that side of, okay, I'm just going to do more and do more. Okay, you know, whether it's my profession or as a Dharma teacher or as a guiding teacher or as a board member, as a father, as a husband, it's like I have a capacity to hold and do a lot, but often at the detriment of myself. You know, so for myself, when that happens, what's most helpful, what I've found for myself, is to notice kind of that internal mechanism that makes that holding possible, right? The internal belief, the internal identification around that, that puts myself, okay, I'm less than, so I have to prove myself, or I have to give in order to be loved, or whatever it might be. That deeper quality, if that's not acknowledged and seen, it's going to continue to drive, right? But when it's acknowledged and seen, then suddenly there's this choice point that happens up. If it's not seen, I'm very susceptible to being manipulated or being caught up in the work, you know, overworking myself. But if I can feel that deeper quality of holding myself equally, I mean, that's a big stretch. You know, for myself, it's just, okay, I'm going to hold myself equally to someone else, my own needs equally. Just to do that, there's a tremendous amount of compassion that has to come in to be able to do that, to be able to hold that belief and to say, okay, yeah, it's okay to be late or to not go to that event or to sleep in, you know, in that sense of, that's often an edge for myself. So I think, you know, generally a good rule of thumb is to notice our natural tendency and then distrust that tendency and kind of go play with going the opposite of that, right? So if we tend to overwork and always step up, stepping back and letting someone else lead the charge, someone else to take on that responsibility, can be very, not only healthy, but also very spiritually in forming. Because, you know, me sitting down and not doing something, I have to work really hard to process, to hold that experience in the body, to feel the, all the stuff that's churning up by not doing something. It's much easier for me to go up and do all this stuff, even though I get worn out. So I think that's the first thing, is to kind of see what's my own buy-in, what's what I get out of this. And once there's clarity with that, then you look at the work situation and say, well, this is one of those work environments that requires that. That's a culture that requires that. And maybe that doesn't fit my understanding anymore. And is there a way to find a way to go through that? If we've been doing it a long time, we have more options. We're more senior. If we're younger or less senior, we have to kind of think about making a different career choice. So it's kind of like we, you know, often we kind of fall into, I think Hendrick said, we often fall in love with someone because they represent those unmet aspects of our, you know, that our parents didn't meet with us. So we wake up 6 months later, realize we've married the worst aspects of both our parents combined, you know, that kind of a thing. And we have to, you know, that's like a great opportunity to learn and grow from that. Same thing with work. You know, we often are drawn to something that also meets our deeper wounding or deeper neuroses. And so we can either act from that, or we can learn to actually change it, to actually purify it. There's not an easy answer. Yeah, I know it's hard, because we need income. You know, sometimes we need the benefit, the financial benefit that comes from that. But, you know, just holding the question, we can start to find that, I think for many of us, just having 10%, 5% more space can make a tremendous difference. And often, you know, workplaces that feel so tight, you can kind of stretch it that much. You can bring a little bit more stretch. Take your vacation leave, you know, take those sick days, whatever it might be. You're welcome. Yes.
I'm in a situation as a retiree, sort of in the process of returning part-time to my professional work. And I've been saying to myself, well, this is the way I could most be useful in my community, is by returning to work in my profession. But then I'm wondering, is it because I'm not able to disattach from the professional role, and yeah, I guess I'm sort of asking for some guidance to make that distinction.
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. So just to repeat it for the recording, having that sense of attachment to role and identity around work, having retired from that role, and then coming back into that part-time, and there's this thought that maybe I'm doing it because it's the best use, that I can be the most beneficial to my community that way. Or maybe it's because I'm uneasy with being not in that role. You know, how do I decide between those two? Well, how can you decide? How can you discern between those? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Sense it in the body. So there's, when we have a question, like a burning question like that, and you know, as a Dharma teacher, constantly people come up with, you know, what should I do about this and about that? And as Tuari said last week, it's, their Dharma is not about solving the problems, you know, giving you the set of answers, but more about giving you the skill to discern for yourself. And certainly we can start to look at going into the mind and going to the sense of concepts, that can be like a maze. It can be very hard to find our way through that. Because you can have a thought that says, oh, this is very altruistic, this is very beneficial, or the thought that maybe this is being, you know, I'm avoiding feeling this discomfort of being unidentified. Coming into the body and just holding the question and just noticing, how does the body sit with that? You know, play with the two extremes. Okay, I'm not going to work at all. what comes up with the body with that? There's a sense of, you know, release and ease? Or is there a sense of, I don't know what to do with that? You know, that gives you information. There's a sense of going into the work world and saying, oh, there's a sense of excitement, a sense of kind of bolstering myself up. And I'll forget the image of like taking some clay and kind of molding into some shape. Like, okay, I'm forming myself into this role again, and that feels good to be solid again. And then sometimes playing with, okay, if I let go of that and it just started to dissolve, what comes up with that? And by doing that, you can start to see, you know, which part of that, it's probably the bottom line is mixed. It's probably both. There's a part of you that really wants to give in that way, and certainly spending your whole, much of your work life cultivating a set of skills, there is a lot of value in giving that back. And there's also that holding on to that role. So can you be in that role of giving back, but at the same time not taking it so seriously? You know, it's like Mr. Rogers. You know how he would come out of the street and he would change his clothes? Okay, now I'm in a different clothes. Can you do that with your work? Okay, I'm going to take off my work clothes and now I'm in a different role. Or do I keep that, you know, am I like Superman with my suit underneath me so I can pull it off at any moment? Yeah, so the just trusting the knowledge of the body and trusting the sense of, if you're not sure, that's a wisdom in itself. Just to be with that, sit with that. And it's going to be a fruitful exercise if you just keep holding that question. You know, what's the motivation? And it's, I mean, it sounds like you're doing good in the community, so you're not causing harm. Yeah. So that's a good bottom line, but it's a very good point of inquiry for whatever role that we do, whatever we do in our lives. You know, as I do that as a teacher, as a Dharma teacher, when Rodney, you know, asked or drafted me into this role, you know, there's like, okay, am I doing that to bolster the sense of self? Or am I coming from this lineage of 2,600 years that's flowing through me and I'm just this empty vehicle for that? And so always that sense of deep honesty. Where am I coming from? Yes, Jason.
Could you maybe just speak a little on your experience of having sila grow and evolve, and as it's cultivated, how that affects the view of changing careers versus finding ways to manifest those attributes within your career?
So the question is around sila and the sense of that growing understanding and relationship of that, and how specifically that affects the sense of job and how the alignment of that or not, and how do you choose between changing a different work or finding a place of being engaged within that work? Is that basically it? So certainly sila, it's probably this way with many things. There's kind of a stage where you're kind of clueless around it, and then you kind of wake up to it. You start to hear about it. You start to look, it's like a list I go through. Okay, I'm going to try to follow these, but it's really an external form that I'm doing, like the martial arts. I'm swinging the sword in a particular way because I'm just copying it, but there's no internal understanding of what that's like. Okay, so that's helpful. And then at some point becomes a... there's kind of a fundamental stage we all go through. Like, a fundamentalist is what I mean by that. It's like, you know, when you go and you're kind of better than everyone else and say, you know, you really should work on your sila, or you should be more mindful. You need to go on a retreat. That would be really good for you. That kind of stage that we go through, right? We know it's kind of that sophomore sense of being very adamant and clear and knowing, feel like you know everything, right? And there's a point when that point in our practice, it's much more kind of clear cut in some ways. Things are very it seems very clear that I should either, you know, leave this work or find something different. But as it starts to mature, as you go from the external form of sila to the internal form, we start to hold it not as this imposed commandments given by a higher authority, but actually to an internal understanding of what is harmful, what is kind, what is in integrity. Not because I would only do that if someone's watching me, but I would do it if no one ever knew I did that. That sense of deep integrity, that just going that way causes pain. This is the transformation from external form to internal form. So it becomes integrated. So then the sword, martial art analogy, you're cutting, but there's this internalness that you can be standing under the alignment of already done the cut without the physical action. In that case, and when that matures in that way, then the sense of working within whatever work you might do, you start to see all the possibilities. And sometimes you see even things which may have much more charge around it becomes, okay, how can I be as ethical in the midst of this? How can I start to move this in a way that really honors that internal understanding? So that's been my understanding of my process. Yes, Peter. Sila, oh yes, so thank you. So sila is often translated as ethics. It's probably the best way. So we're talking about the precepts, the sense of non-harm, of not stealing, truthfulness, not sexual misconduct, and heedfulness, not leading to heedlessness. So sila is one of the main branches of the tradition. The Buddha would often start with sila and generosity as foundational practices. Because if you're going around stealing and harming, you're not going to be very settled in your mind. There's going to be so much internal turbulence. So it's really a foundational thing. The way this practice came from the West, for some reason I've been a little, hesitant about putting that out as a foundational. I think, if you came to a beginning class and I said, okay, do not steal, do not, most people would leave. But if you give them the tools to actually look inside, they can start to make that connection. So, for better or worse, that's how we tend to do it. Yes, Barbara. Yes. Yes, absolutely. So the comment is the sense of the inverted ego attachment, that we can be attached to, kind of being, we could say, full of ourselves in our world. But we can also be the opposite, kind of the mirror image of that. Oh, I can't hold that. I don't want to own that role of being a writer. That for example. And yeah, absolutely. Remember the second noble truth, there's a different forms of tanha, of craving, of thirst. This is really the deep mechanism that leads to dukkha. And there's the thirst to become, to be a certain way. There's also the thirst to not be a certain way, to not become. And it's very identical. It's much of a problem to not want to own that role, not to step into it. Because yeah, you're going inversely from that. And so there's a different kind of identity, though, around that. There's identity that I'm not good enough, or I'm not accomplished enough. I've written a book, but it wasn't, whatever disclaimer we might say about that, right? That's all, if you look closely, that's all clustered around a certain identity, a certain role. Just if you were like an author and saying, oh, my book is the best, and that's clustered around a certain identity also. Right? So it's that process of clustering, whether it's around a positive identity, egotistical identity, or a egotistical identity that's more self-disminishment. It's still that clustering. So really the Dharma practice is saying, in that clustering, what's the center of gravity in that? What's drawing everything around that? Right? As long as that's intact and uninvestigated, we will experience dukkha. We'll experience suffering. And whether that role is given to us or taken away, there's that deeper quality. And so this is an investigation that's both the psychological, but really goes much deeper than the psychological, that to that very center of gravity, that core of gravity that forms around that. And so the work of that, to start to kind of play with the edges, this is where wise action really comes in, is to play with kind of being a little egotistical. And saying, I published a book. I haven't, but she has. kind of holding that, playing with that edge. And when you do that, you'll feel all that internal like dissonance, that sense of unease. And this is the tricky piece, that if you just listen to that sense of feeling uneasy, you think, oh, that's not the right way to go. But you really know that is exactly the right way to go. Because you start to loosen that quality of identification. As that core piece of gravity starts to lose its pull, there's dis-ease that comes from that. Right, just the same as if, like Sashi, with his profession, I'm not saying you're egotistical around that, but just being, I have that profession, I'm no longer working, there's that gravity is starting to come apart. There's that dis-ease with that. Just like that sense of, okay, I'm going to step up and disprove that diminishment, that not being worthy of center of gravity, that also has that sense of dis-ease in the body. So that's why I started the meditation with this quality of relaxing. So when that dissonance arises in our body, what do we do with it? How do we work with that? If we go into thought around it, we get lost very easily. But if we go into the body and say, okay, how can I have a sense of softening, a sense of relaxing around that? And that starts to allow the body to relax around that. Okay, then you stand up and say, hey, I published a book and it's about this and I'm an expert in this field. Okay, and you can feel all the dissonance come up and just let the body hold it. Let the body start to drain it. Because ultimately we want to be very versatile, that we can stand up in front of 1,000 people and proclaim our brilliance, or equally be completely silent. And internally, it doesn't make any difference. You're welcome. Perhaps space for one more. Yes, Anna.
I really love that last question from Barbara, because I've had that same issue where I've been very attached to the roles, and I either feel like I'm too good for them or not good enough for them. Mm. And for the last few years I haven't worked, and so I've felt really a lot of internal and probably made up external pressure that I should be working. And actually, it's fine. I'm not working. I have savings. I'm spending. And it's fine. And no dependence. And it's fine. And I've done a lot of retreats and things I enjoy. And I've been working on my core issue, which is this idea that I'm illegitimate. In that story, just now when you guys were talking about that, I just dropped in that phrase, which I practice with every once in a while, I'm illegitimate. And I said, what if I couldn't believe that thought? What if that was not true? What if that didn't exist? And there was like nothing there. It removed that whole clump of clay that you're talking about. And that was kind of a scary thing, actually.
Yeah.
If I'm not this core belief, then what am I? And there was a whole lot of like space around that and nowhere to stand. So I think that's what I'm doing when I'm saying, I teach the Dharma, but not really. Or I'm a writer, but not really. I mean, and I'm going to graduate school, but not really. I mean, there's all these not going and I'm applying, so let's be on the record. But I just found it very, very useful, and I feel like I got a glimpse of freedom there, and that it's my thoughts and my beliefs that I'm clinging to that are causing this suffering.
Yes, yeah, nicely said. Let me see if I can repeat some of that for the recording. Basically, the sense of resonance with the last question and how going through working and not working and that kind of life circumstances, going to school, writing and not writing. But the core of it, that sense of being illegitimate. And when you touched on that and questioned, who would I be without that if that wasn't believed in? And when she asked that question, there's a sense of that falling away and that sense of the clay falling away and a sense of, a little bit of fear, a little bit of disorientation around that, but also a sense of freedom that came from that. And I think that's a very nicely way of describing it, that this kind of core center of gravity often, if you listen very deeply, has a sense of a belief, like something like, I'm illegitimate. Right? And sometimes we can really listen to that, really hear it so deeply to see that. And then we say, okay, who am I without that? I mean, it seems that counterintuitive that if you let go of that, you should feel pretty good, right? But letting go of that, it's like you're letting go of this whole gravity field. You're letting go of that whole sense of identity. And that, unless you see that hunger to not be or to be, and what happens if that hunger dissipates, fear is like a landmark of that dissipation, right? It's like the guardians of the gateway toward freedom, toward liberation. It's like they throw fear at you, but if you cannot buy into that, not listen to that, and actually trust that, but basically, it's as one teacher said, it's like the end of your world. It's the end of who you take yourself to be. And so, if you let go of that. How do you get to that point of letting go? It's tricky because sometimes we have to spend a lot of time really listening to that. I was just on a retreat with Ajahn Chichito, and he would talk about just like that very painful part, just being very tender with it. Like, listen, let me hear you. Let me listen to that voice. And so it's not like we're throwing that out, but listening so clearly. And once there's a sense of really listening and asking, who am I without this? And then that often just allows that to fade. And it's like, okay, who am I without it? It's like, I don't know. So you have to be more and more comfortable with not knowing who we are, with not being able to define, this is who I am, this is the role I am, this is the role I am not, I'm not this, right? And when that happens, then there's a freedom that you can see this is play. And then I can put on, like Mr. Rogers, I can put on my clothes when I need to do this, and then I can set that aside. Great, thank you. All right, thank you for your very engaged questions, and it really fleshes out the topic and makes it very applicable for these people here.